For RightsCast recaps, discounts on editing services, and educational content delivered to your inbox once a month, you can subscribe to the R.R. Campbell Writes newsletter over at rrcampbellwrites.com/newsletter. Again, that's rrcampbellwrites.com/newsletter. Thanks for listening.
Whoa, hey, what's this new music I hear? Has the RightsCast gone to the wayside?
No, it hasn't. What you're hearing now is the intro music to a new member of the RightsCast family, which will continue to expand as we advance through 2018 and beyond. Hey there, I'm R.R. Campbell, and welcome to the first of these RightsCast expansions, the Biblio Breakdown. What's a Biblio Breakdown, you ask? Well, in every Biblio Breakdown, we'll examine a book from the perspective of a writer, with an emphasis on examining the book's structure, characterization, concept, and more. In doing this, our goal is to better understand how other writers are tackling these things in their own work, and then let that inform our own writing as we see fit. In this episode, we'll do a deep dive into the inciting incident, characterization through relationships, relationships as metaphor, setting as character, and dramatic irony as featured in Khaled Hosseini's A Thousand Splendid Suns. If you haven't read A Thousand Splendid Suns, there's no need to worry. I'll provide context along the way to make sure we're all in a position to learn the lessons this harrowing work of historical fiction has in store for us. With that in mind, let's get familiar with the book as a whole before we begin an analysis of A Thousand Splendid Suns' inciting incident. Per this trimmed-down version of the book blurb, A Thousand Splendid Suns is the story of two Afghan women, born a generation apart and with very different ideas about love and family. As they endure the ever-escalating dangers around them, in their home, as well as in the streets of Kabul, they come to form a bond that makes them both sisters and mother-daughter to each other, and bond that will ultimately alter the course not just of their own lives, but of the next generation as well. Before we continue, I want to say I wholeheartedly recommend this book to anyone who feels they may have even only a casual interest in it after listening to this episode. Biblio breakdowns aren't meant to be reviews or recommendations, but if you haven't made time to read this one since its debut, you absolutely must. Alright, it's analysis time. Let's get right into it by looking at the book's inciting incident. For the uninitiated, the inciting incident is the moment that hooks the reader into the story, often setting the character on the trajectory they'll follow for the remainder of the book. As writers, we know the first five pages of any manuscript are crucial, as these are the pages we need to introduce that hook or inciting incident. It's within these five pages, or fewer if possible, that we need to give readers a look in at our protagonist, what that protagonist wants, what it is that might try to stop them from getting what they want, and then what our protagonist might plan to do about that obstacle, more or less. Then, of course, the goal of our inciting incident is to accomplish all of that in as compelling of a way as possible, often by introducing a spectacular change moment where a suggestion of the stakes, too, comes into play. To do all of this, it's not uncommon, at least in my case anyway, to want to give those first five pages some spectacular action or a body count or the breaking of a severe bit of news to propel our protagonist to action. What A Thousand Splendid Suns shows us, however, is that the first five pages don't have to be loaded with explosions and space invasions to draw readers in. Rather, Khaled Hosseini's approach to the inciting incident is actually much more foreboding than any of that. The following excerpt is from the end of the second and beginning of the third paragraphs of the book. In this scene, Miriam, our protagonist, is a young child who is climbing a chair to retrieve her deceased mother's Chinese tea set from its perch. Nana, the other character in the scene, is Miriam's grandmother, with whom Miriam lives. This excerpt reads as follows. Nana cherished each blue and white porcelain piece, the graceful curve of the pot's spout, the hand-painted finches and chrysanthemums, the dragon on the sugar bowl, meant to ward off evil. It was this last piece that slipped from Miriam's fingers, that fell to the wooden floorboards of the kolba and shattered. All right, did you catch it? I don't mean the porcelain sugar bowl, of course, but rather the inciting incident. It's in there, but it's easy to miss. Remember how it mentions the dragon on the sugar bowl is meant to ward off evil? Yup. That, of course, is the piece that Miriam shatters. Before we go any further, let me be clear. A Thousand Splendid Suns is not a work of magic realism. There was no actual ward or protective seal on the sugar bowl, and yet for a book that pits myth against modernity and past against present, the shattering of this sugar bowl means everything. It sets the stage for the direction of Miriam's arc, one which will lead her through incredible evil, but conversely, incredible bittersweet triumph as well.
The point is this. The subtlety in this scene teaches us that one's inciting incident can, just like the explosive alternatives, also propel an entire novel forward. In A Thousand Splendid Suns, Hosseini crafts his inciting incident such that readers can't help but feel drawn in by the sense of foreboding that comes with the simple act of a sugar bowl having broken. I know he had me intrigued from page one anyway. So let's try an exercise. When you have the time, write a scene or inciting incident that propels a story forward through the use of subtlety or metaphor, like Hosseini's done in the breaking of the sugar bowl in A Thousand Splendid Suns. How will this new scene you write compare to other inciting incidents you've put together, and how might you reframe your approach to writing scenes like this going forward? Do you have any thoughts on inciting incidents? Have you seen something similar to what Khaled Hosseini has done in A Thousand Splendid Suns in another book? Let me know by email at writescast@gmail.com or on Twitter at writescast or @IamRRCampbell. I'd love to hear from you. Having covered inciting incidents, let's transition into characterization through relationships as the next focus point of this biblio breakdown. So, overall, of course, we're talking characterization, or the manner through which character is revealed on the page. For this breakdown of A Thousand Splendid Suns, we'll be looking specifically at how inter-character relationships and the relationships our characters have to the cultures they inhabit prove to be some of the most effective ways to reveal character. Now, if there's ever a book that proves character is more than just a list of traits, A Thousand Splendid Suns is that book. If that sounds odd coming from me, the guy whose website literally presents character as a list of traits over at rrcampbellwrites.com, well, let's explore how we get from a list of traits to the relationships between characters themselves, and then explore what that buys us as writers. By page 2 of A Thousand Splendid Suns, we learned that one of our point of view characters, Miriam, is a harami, or a child had out of wedlock. Let's imagine we're completing a list of character traits as part of our outlining process. Surely this detail about Miriam would figure among the things on the list that define her. But, of course, no one is a harami in a vacuum. Though we as people strive to define ourselves as individuals in the real world, we're also inevitably a summation of our relationships and interactions to and with others as well. Our manuscripts and our characters should then, unsurprisingly, be no different. It's in this way, then, that it's critical for us as writers to not understand only who our characters are as individuals, but also who they are relative to the other people in their lives. We see this in A Thousand Splendid Suns when Khaled Hosseini establishes a dynamic through which Miriam is inevitably estranged from her father and his quote-unquote real family, instead banished to live with her mother in a kolba on the outskirts of her father's estate. This, in turn, leads Miriam to want nothing more than to have a relationship with her wealthy father, whom she idolizes, which puts great stress on her as an individual character because her relationship to her father, as defined by the culture in which they exist, inhibits them from being seen together publicly. That is to say, we learn more about Miriam through her relationship, or lack thereof, with her father than we ever could if Miriam were simply left to her own devices. In other words, to understand Miriam, we have to understand her relationship to those nearest her and, as suggested earlier, also to the culture in which she lives. And it's this notion of culture where another dimension of characterization through relationships comes into play. We, and our characters, are defined not just by our relationships to those around us, but by the cultures to which we belong. Miriam's status as a harami is what prevents her and her father from being as close as Miriam would like the two of them to be. And, as such, we can through this lens begin to understand how Miriam feels about the world in which she lives. That is to say, inter-character relationships are a gateway to understanding individual characters themselves, who then themselves become gateways to understanding the worlds that our characters inhabit. One hand feeds the other, feeds the next, so to speak. So what does this mean for us as writers? Well, all of this is a demonstration that, again, nothing exists in a vacuum. Consider these questions for an exercise. How can we know who our characters truly are if we don't have an understanding of the culture they inhabit? How are our characters seen by others, and how do they react similarly or differently when in the presence of any given set of other characters? Are our characters more prideful and outgoing when comfortable with those and the dynamics that surround them? Are they meek and cowering before individuals in an environment where society expects them to be deferential? Or do our characters cast tradition to the wind and insist on violating cultural norms? What are the consequences they or others face, if any, as a result of the path they choose to take? In A Thousand Splendid Suns, Miriam's status as a harami defines her significantly for at least the first fifth of the book and continues to haunt her throughout the entire text. In this way, Hosseini has crafted something of a cultural antagonist, which is something that cannot be overlooked as a possibility when crafting our own manuscripts. It also helps define inter-character relationships, which enriches readers' understandings of individual characters as well. Have any thoughts on inter-character relationships and how they contribute to characterization of individual characters? Again, feel free to reach out to me at writescast@gmail.com or on Twitter @writescast. It'd be great to hear from you and what it is that you find when you're reading other titles, or if you've read A Thousand Splendid Suns, perhaps you have a take on this of your own. I'd love to hear all about it, so again, feel free to reach out to me if you'd like. Now that we have an understanding of how a thorough knowledge of culture and inter-character relationships can help us improve our manuscript's depth, let's take a look at how these same relationships can also be used as metaphor and, as a result, help us to really drive home our theme. To do this, we're going to have to get pretty theoretical, so bear with me as we walk through this step by step. Now, once we as writers have established a strong inter-character relationship foundation, we can actually build upon that in such a way that these relationships grow upward beyond the terrestrial world of the page and into a sort of atmosphere that surrounds the world of the book itself. For the purposes of this conversation, we'll call this atmosphere the metasphere. Yes, that's right, the metasphere. Before you get to wondering what I'm smoking, consider this. Like our characters, this is a recurring theme, of course, nothing exists in a vacuum, including the books we read and write. That is to say, we must consider all things against a greater context, which, for our readers, includes things like the society in which they're living as they read, the history of the cultures in which we write, and the presentation of our book's subject matter. Woe be it of me to suggest that writers must actively be considering all of the above as a necessity when writing, but if these matters are considered when writing, one can craft a manuscript with an even further enriched theme using the power of nuance and subtlety by pulling from the metasphere to shape readers' understandings of characters, plot, and theme. Where A Thousand Splendid Suns does this masterfully is through the use of interpersonal relationships as a metaphor for the greater socio-political constructs of 20th century Afghanistan. This may sound boring, but trust me, it's not, especially because the author doesn't stand upon a soapbox and harp about the struggle for Afghan national identity in a manner that one might expect if this were a work of nonfiction. Instead, he reaches into the metasphere and makes use of character relationships to shape the astute reader's appreciation for the complexities of Afghanistan's relationship to itself. This appreciation can also extend beyond Afghanistan to any nation facing a similar crisis of identity, which I believe makes this exploration especially salient. Let's examine this concretely. I found the exploration of this theme to be most prevalent in the book's first 50 pages or so, though it runs throughout, so we'll limit our discussion to this early section of the book as to avoid spoilers. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, A Thousand Splendid Suns features two prospective characters, one of whom is Miriam, the child had out of wedlock by the wealthy, forward-looking Jalil, and Nana, Miriam's lore-bound, myth-hustling mother. The dynamic Khaled Hosseini creates between these three characters and the culture in which they live is already rife with tension. Miriam, our protagonist, is pulled in opposing directions constantly, but deep down knows what she really wants, or thinks she does anyway. And that's to be with her father, living in the cozy, sealed-off world he has created for himself and his, quote-unquote, real family. As the relationship dynamics between Miriam, Jalil, and Nana are explored, readers begin to understand. Not explicitly from the words on the pages themselves, mind you, but rather through the lens of the metasphere, that Miriam's father, Jalil, represents an unattainable dream. Not just for Miriam personally, but for Afghanistan as a whole. As time progresses and the cozy, sweater-like feel of Jalil's world and Miriam's relationship to it begins to fray, readers are introduced to the notion that the dream itself may be a lie. Unattainable not because it's generally impossible, but because it's in a constant struggle against the harsh realities of the cultural stasis as represented by Miriam's mother, Nana. Nana, unlike Jalil, is an absolute lore monger, deferring to tradition to define herself, Miriam, and any kind of future the two of them might have as a family or as individuals. Nana holds back Miriam through purposeful manipulation and distortion, all in an attempt to keep Miriam from abandoning her and the world she represents in favor of the promise Jalil represents, even if there is a chance that the future he represents is unattainable. So Mariam then, like 20th century Afghanistan itself, faces a choice. Does she cling to her past, or risk pushing forward toward what she believes to be a brighter future, even if that would mean possible instability or a different kind of disillusionment in itself? Where Mariam is concerned, the choice she makes goes on to define her for the rest of her life. And I can't exactly dive into too many details without revealing a major plot point, so we'll leave it at that for now. Are you still with me? Alright, let's consider an exercise to explore this idea of the metasphere in our own work. Take a look at a bit of fiction you've written or are working on. When you read it, do you with ease see any connections between the words on the page and the metasphere or the world that the reader inhabits? Do these connections help you shape your theme, better define your characters, or enrich the relationship between the reader and the story itself? If so, is this something you think you did intentionally? Does this enhance or detract from the story you're trying to tell? If you don't see a relationship between your work and the metasphere, what do you think you could do to introduce this if you feel it to be necessary? Can your characters' relationships, the world in which they live, or the hardships they endure be shaped through nuance and subtlety to create a greater connection between the story itself and the context in which a reader enjoys it? If this seems daunting, never fear. This is all very high-level stuff, the kind of thing that it's maybe worth simply having an awareness of for now. Next, we'll tackle setting as a character unto itself, which may be a bit easier to ground ourselves in than relationships as metaphor or the metasphere. But, of course, if you have any thoughts on this topic as well, again, that's rightscast@gmail.com. Let me know that the metasphere is a bunch of nonsense that I decided to make up one morning because I had too much coffee. That's cool. Call me out. Let's have a discussion on it. You may very well be right. But I do think it's generally important to consider context in all things as much as we're able. And if we can use that context to better shape our readers' understanding of a book, or if we can use that to further enrich our theme, then I think we're moving in the right direction. Alright, it's time for setting as character. To dive into this, I think it's important that we recognize setting is more than just place. In a handful of posts at rrcampbellwrites.com, I've discussed how location can actually become a character itself. Think of the Wall from Game of Thrones or the A Song of Ice and Fire series, or the Silo from Hugh Howey's Wool. Then, of course, there's Room from Emma Donaghy's 2010 bestseller of the same name. All of these places rebuff the idea that setting is simply the location where a given scene takes place. Even given these examples, one aspect of setting that can often be overlooked is time. In other words, it's not just the where, but the when, too. In A Thousand Splendid Suns, however, though Hosseini does provide us with a where that becomes a character of its own, it's really how he treats the when that makes this book a masterclass on the use of time as character. Of course, we as people are shaped by the times in which we live, and our characters should be no different. As the prospective characters in A Thousand Splendid Suns grow and struggle throughout their lives, the city of Kabul, and Afghanistan more broadly, does as well. In the earliest parts of the book, we have a glimpse into an Afghanistan with progressive urban leanings, but as the country and our main characters endure the overthrow of its leadership in a communist coup, followed by Soviet occupation, followed by an attempt to establish a democracy, followed by a civil war, followed by the seizure of control by the Taliban, and then the eventual overthrow in the 2000s that leads to the occupation of United States forces. Through all of this, our characters' daily lives are impacted immensely by the ongoing turmoil, loss of life, and the sociopolitical tendencies of those in power. The lesson we can take away from all of that is this. For those of us writing fiction of any kind, but especially historical fiction, the times in which our characters flourish or fail should not be disregarded. Time itself can make the world feel more lived in and fill the role of an additional antagonist or ally when placed in the proper context. So let's consider another exercise. Think about not where, but when your work in progress takes place. What is your main character's relationship to the times in which they live? Do they feel very much a part of the zeitgeist or rather detached from it? If they feel detached, why? How can their attachment or detachment from their world's goings-on help define their journey and your theme as the author? Once you've answered these questions for your main character, consider them for your supporting cast as well. They too surely have opinions and reactions of their own to share. Lastly, let's touch on dramatic irony. If you're unfamiliar with the term, dramatic irony occurs when the reader knows something that the perspective Dramatic irony occurs when the reader knows something that the perspective character does not. Think of a horror film or a book where you've known the killer is waiting just inside a door and our unwitting protagonist is reaching for that door's handle. "No, no, no," you shout, all because you're in the know about the killer on the opposite side of the door, whereas our perspective character has no idea what they're in for. In A Thousand Splendid Suns, there's at least one instance of dramatic irony that's so salient I couldn't help but mention it as part of this breakdown. I mentioned earlier that this novel takes place across a number of decades and seismic shifts in the power structures that govern the daily lives of Afghanistan's citizens, including through the mid to late 2000s. There's a scene during the times of the Taliban's rule that begins as seemingly innocuous, or as innocuous as possible, all things considered. But as our prospective characters learn more about the events unfolding in New York City on an entirely different continent, readers are able to start assembling the pieces on their own. That the 9/11 attacks have happened, and the American invasion and occupation of Afghanistan will certainly come next. Readers in this scenario have access to information that our characters do not, namely that the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon will have tremendous consequences for the characters' daily lives, which is a perfect example of dramatic irony. You, as the reader, are in the know, and the characters don't know better. In fact, even if one is only tangentially familiar with Afghanistan's history, there are moments of dramatic irony laced throughout the story. Specifically, I'm referring to the Soviet occupation, the eventual takeover of the Taliban, and then, of course, the subsequent invasion by US forces. Interestingly, all of this dramatic irony is a further testament to the value of setting as character and, most specifically, time as character. Had the story taken place at another time in Afghanistan's history, or had the author chosen to ignore or de-emphasize the setting's historical context, the dramatic irony would either have not existed or played a significantly diminished role. In A Thousand Splendid Suns, however, dramatic irony plays a major part in one's journey as a reader. Even when our prospective characters achieve minor victories, history tells us that earth-shattering change is right around the corner, and with it, almost exclusively a worsening of our characters' situations. So here's one final exercise for you to consider. Are there moments in your own work where dramatic irony comes into play? If not, could playing with point of view to introduce dramatic irony help increase the tension on the page? Or perhaps you could reach out into the metasphere and use the context that readers have while they're reading that book in the real world to help introduce a sense of dramatic irony, as we've seen with A Thousand Splendid Suns. Regardless of the path you take, there are ways to effectively use dramatic irony in your own work, and Khaled Hosseini's A Thousand Splendid Suns gives us some great examples of that. Alright, that wraps it up for this biblio breakdown of Khaled Hosseini's A Thousand Splendid Suns. I hope you learned something, or at least feel like you can tackle your own writing or reading from a fresh perspective. If you have feedback on this episode, I'd sincerely love to hear it, so please email me at writescast@gmail.com or tweet at me at writescast or at @IamRRCampbell on Twitter. I'd love to incorporate your feedback into my vision for this spin-off series as I begin to work on more episodes over time. If you'd like a recap of this episode without listening to it again, you can actually find most of this episode's contents tidily arranged in a 3-part blog post series over at rrcampbellwrites.com/bibliobreakdown, where I also have other blog versions of biblio breakdowns for other books available. Again, that URL is rrcampbellwrites.com/bibliobreakdown. That's /BIBLIO breakdown. I'd love to see you there. Thanks for listening. As always, I need to extend a major word of thanks to Kristen Oakley, whose support of the WritesCast at $3 per episode through patreon.com/WritesCast is a major boon in helping the WritesCast network become self-sustaining. In exchange for her patronage, Kristen gets some great rewards, some of which are available to Patreons who pledge at $1 or $2 per episode as well. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a contributing member to the WritesCast network of podcasts, you can head to patreon.com/WritesCast. Thanks again. I hope you'll tune in next time. In the meantime, write on and write well.